Good evening. Welcome to Third Thursday Community Conversations. I'm Jay Anderson. Each month we sit down with interesting guests for an exchange of information, opinions, and points of view. Tonight we continue our series of broadcasts featuring volunteers in the community, men and women who give their time to make organizations like WTIP and other nonprofits in the community stay strong and healthy through their hard work and dedication. My guests are Vicki Biggs Anderson, Phyllis Parker, Mike Carlson, and Jeff Kern and Kathy Sullivan. That's June's Third Thursday Community Conversations. Mike Carlson is the quintessential Cook County volunteer. He's everywhere in many different capacities, and it shows in his strong sense of community. You're a very active volunteer.
I guess I am.
Yes. And because I see your name on all kinds of community activities and organizations. So tell us about them, some of them, past and present.
Oh, sure. Well, I'm involved with service in a number of different ways in different organizations. The Art Colony is one where I'm actively involved, Lions Club, the Community Foundation, the Congregational Church, Food Shelf, the First and Second Store I get involved with indirectly as an organization. Occasionally even at WTIP. It's been a little while since I've done anything here. But
have you been doing this for a long time?
Yeah, I've been doing volunteer work for much of my life, I think, one way or another.
So before you came up here, you were doing volunteer
work? Oh, sure. I mean, it starts with Cub Scouts and such. You know, there's, you go, oh. if you really trace it back, you know. Mm-hmm.
And you were in where, the Twin Cities?
I was in Minneapolis, right. Okay. And there I was involved with things like Computer Club. I was actively involved in founding and running a Macintosh user group, for instance, and Macintosh Consultants Group. I was involved with the Water Quality Issues Minneapolis. I did water monitoring for one thing and served on a committee that planned for wetlands. And Neighborhood Association was a big thing in Minneapolis, delivering the Bryn Mawr Bugle and other kinds of things that were involved with the Neighborhood Association.
Yeah, computers are your background, right?
I did computing work for about 18 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then how long have you been up here?
About 16 years.
And did you jump right into the volunteer scene?
Yeah, we were actually doing some volunteer work, I think, before we completely moved into the house. I think we got involved with the advisory board for the community education before we'd moved our cats in. I think that was the, that's a measure of when you
so
actually
you
moved.
BC and an,
yeah,
an
before
AC,
the cat.
Okay.
And yeah.
So what kind of activities are a draw for you? What do you look for?
Well, I look for something that's interesting and something that occasionally a little challenging, things that match my skills. And I was thinking about this, there's a lot of different kinds of volunteer work that are related to this community and outside communities as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of breaking it down from the looking at my notes a bit, that it's, you know, it's actually doing the work is one of the kinds of things you're doing as volunteer. In other cases, you're doing work to raise money. In other cases, you're doing governance of an organization. And within those, of course, they break down in very many different ways, too.
What tends to be the big draw, the governance or the work or all of it?
Well, the time often seems to be governance. You spend a lot of hours at meetings and planning sessions and retreats and such. But the doing the work is actually what probably takes the most time. And it can be menial work. You know, it's the cleaning and sorting and hauling trash and hauling recycling, skilled work, you know, gardening. I've been maintaining some garden works in the community. I'll walk through Harbor Park and weed, you know, as a very casual volunteer kind of thing. And then there's slightly more professional things that people, you know, myself and others do, where you're doing training, you're doing service, you're doing tutoring. Maybe you're trying to get somebody's computer to work and, you know, doing it as a volunteer rather than but it's something that's at a professional level.
Tutoring, what would you be tutoring?
Well, I was a math teacher before I was in computers, so I have done some basic math education with primarily with young adults, people who have wanted to go back to college and don't have the basic math skills.
Really? You're a mathematician?
I have a bachelor's degree in math education, yes, of course.
Okay. Computers, lots of opportunities to work with people in computers. Are you finding our population here fairly computer literate?
Oh, they are. And that's something I tried to leave behind as much as possible when I moved up here. I did my career in computers, and I wasn't planning to do a lot of volunteer work in computers. I did a little bit up here, and occasionally a tiny bit of paid work, but I've tried to keep that way in the background. But computers are somewhat friendly to me, so sometimes I can make things work. If I go into the Art Colony office and the computer's not working, I wave my hand and somehow it occasionally works. And sometimes by putting the plug in correctly, things like that.
Oh, is there any truth to that where if it doesn't work, you pull the plug in and then you put it back in?
Is still one of the resetting in various ways is still what's big in computing.
So it sounds to me like you play all different kinds of roles.
I do. For different reasons. Some of them are, learning new skills, like at the radio station. I learned a lot of new skills, how to operate the board, how to talk correctly at an appropriate speed, things like that. But there's other things that are fun, like the fundraising kind of work that I sometimes have done is the first and second store, where you're not working so much for that organization as for another organization by working there. And that's a kind of common volunteer thing around the country. Not as much here. First and Second is one of the good examples of that. But anytime you're selling a product or doing a service where you're fundraising for another organization, like if we're for the Fishburger Stand, if I'm selling fish, that I'm not really doing that because I want to sell fish. We're doing it because we want to raise money for the community. And although selling fish is also kind of interesting too.
I see. I noticed your name on the community
fund. Fund, right, which is one of the major involvements in terms of this community in providing money for organizations and providing services. Like we have you've been reading information, thank you very much, about our grant cycle, but also we're doing a presentation for the community and an education session.
So what would your role be with the community fund?
Well, I am involved with the grants committee, so I'll be going through that sorting process of going through the grant applications and selecting who, and hopefully almost everyone that applies, we can provide a grant, or at least we have to select ones which are appropriate. We do a multi-level selection on grants, so most of the people that apply are quite appropriate. It's just a matter of whether we have enough money to satisfy all the demands. Mm-hmm.
So is there any organization or any activity that stands out in your mind? Something that was really enjoyable or maybe really awful?
Oh, well, they're fun. I did quite a few years with the theater and did a lot of the backstage work. I did the work on the soundboard and the lights and working as a stage manager. That was particularly interesting. But I haven't done that for several years now. That's one thing that I probably won't do again, but it was a very challenging thing, very different, something I was not in my purview before I'd moved up here, certainly.
Yeah, you basically said that you tend to be attracted toward volunteer activity that meets your skill sets. And what do you think you bring to these organizations? Are you consider yourself a innovator or a sustainer?
Oh, it depends on the organization too. And some of it's part of what I do is a handyman. You know, that's one thing I do in some organizations, fixing things. You know, it's the Lions have various equipment things that occasionally need to be fixed. Certainly the Art Colony, I've spent a lot of time working on things there. So those handyman skills, having a set of tools that occasionally is useful. I particularly enjoy one other kind of fundraising where I make things that go into sales or auctions. So if I make a table or walking stick, and then that goes to an auction, like for the Eats, it's real fun to see that somebody is actually buying the item I've made, and I'm raising some money for the organization that way. So that's a different kind. That's the craft level of fundraising, where you're using your own skills. And I could be beyond craft. It can be fine art as well, but it's the kind of thing which I particularly enjoy doing.
What do you get out of volunteering personally? What's the biggest reason you do it?
Oh yeah, I've thought about that quite a bit. And there's all sorts of glib and silly, and I do it because I'm incredibly bored and I've got to do something each day. That's the bad answer. But it's a matter of service, of giving back to the community, that what the community's given to you is. And then there's always, you know, I think one Emerson quote is that any time that you do service for others, that service is done for you as well. So there's that enlightened self-interest, I guess, is part of it. Most any volunteer work I do it because I think there's some greater good that's coming from what I do. And either I can see it directly, or I have a sense, well, okay, I can't see what this does, but it's good for the organization.
So do you see any particular needs in this community that would be served by other kinds of organizations, or greater involvement by more people?
Oh, sure. I've often thought that a Habitat for Humanities program would be really good here, that we'd build whoever we would be, the community would build a Habitat house every year in somewhere in Cook County. That would be a great accomplishment. Maybe it hasn't happened. We've talked about that over the years, but there's bigger things that can happen in volunteerism, certainly.
Are we lacking anything?
Yeah, we're lacking jobs, housing, and people, sure.
But I mean, in terms of how that would apply to volunteering, is there something that
I think there's a lot of people that are committed. You know, certainly I'm not the only volunteer out in the community. When volunteer requests go out, people show up in good numbers for most anything. When we've had the time of the blowdown, we've had lots of things. I'm also part of an emergency management committee that was involved during the Ham Lake fire, for instance. And, you know, there are those kinds of groups. And I see people going for training for first responder kind of thing recently. They seem to have a lot of people that are willing to come out and serve in the community.
Are you concerned at all that a lot of people that are volunteers are people that are retired, and that there is not that core of younger people coming up?
Oh, certainly. I'd like to see more younger people involved, and I hope that maybe in listening to this show, people get the idea that, you know, using their skills, or maybe even minimal skills, like I say, many of the volunteer jobs are menial, and some are just things that you do have good skills. Maybe it's phone calling that need to be done. Maybe it's mailing. You know, there are a lot of things that don't require a lot of skills that are important. Organizations usually don't have enough staff to do the work. They don't have enough paid people. Very few organizations in Cook County would say that they are overstaffed. You know, they have maybe they're adequate, but there's usually some things that they want to have done by others. You know, some things are very simple. The highway cleanup projects, for instance, there's various of those organizations that tie into those. Doesn't take much skill. You walk along the highway and pick up garbage for a couple hours.
But somebody needs to do it.
Somebody needs to do it. Yeah, you know, I can't hire enough people to do that, probably.
Any general thoughts on volunteering that you might have?
Well, the thing about a lot of people think that it's governance is a big part, and I do get involved with that. And there's the thought I have about that is that it takes a special kind of person to serve on the boards. I realize that, and I'm not that I'm all that special, but I have a few qualities, I guess, that fit that. I'm relatively patient. I'm often awake at meetings. That I'm willing to listen to other people and be respectful. I do have a sense of understanding of Robert's Rules of Order. And then I think I have a reasonable sense of humor and can occasionally loosen things when issues get tense, for instance.
And they do.
They often do. Yeah, yes. You know, things are important, and they seem more important at a meeting maybe than they really are if you were able to take a break and come back to it a week later. But there are tensions at many meetings.
The kind of volunteering that you do up here in the years that you've been here, is that substantially different than what you were doing in Minneapolis?
Well, some of the things are in terms of the community involvement. There's some very much similarities. I was involved with service auctions in the city. I've been involved with service auctions up here. Service auctions in the city were much bigger than the service auctions up here, but you know, same similar kind of planning involved. I've done a lot of that with the Library Friends. We used to do an auction every year, and pretty big deal to get 400 books organized and on displayed and sold in a few hours on a summer day. We did things like that in Minneapolis, too.
The neighborhood concept in Minneapolis, you mentioned something about that.
Yeah, I was involved with various neighborhoods. I was in Seward neighborhood. I was involved with a planning project there that was a neighborhood that would basically close down. The city bought most of the houses away from their owners and moved them out. And then the local committee decided which of those houses would be rehabbed or which of them would be torn down. And we worked with University of Minnesota architect. We worked with our own private architect, our staff attorney. And it was a really interesting process to go through. And it's Seward West. Many people may know about Milwaukee Avenue in the city of Minneapolis. We managed to redesign a neighborhood and move people back in after it had been essentially emptied out. It was a very strange thing. They have a ghost town for several blocks.
Well, that's interesting because obviously you can't have a conversation about economic development in Cook County without touching almost immediately on affordable housing. Right. But, I mean, how do you organize? I mean, what kind of wherewithal does it take to do something like that?
Yeah, well, that's it. That's why we don't have a lot. It takes a combination of people wanting to live there. You have to have that, you know, desire. People, and take some investment. In Minneapolis, it was a combination of the city and the university and the neighborhood association and but then private investors, you know, people would buy the land. If we had the place where we tore the house down, people would buy the property. If it was a place that was rehabbed, people would buy the house that was rehabbed and either finish the rehabbing themselves or they might buy it as a completely finished unit. It was an interesting process.
That is. I had not was not aware of that kind of activity.
Yeah, it's a neighborhood revitalization program is a kind of thing that has been done for quite a while. I mean, this was way back in the 70s that I was involved with that one. In Bryn Mawr, it was a different neighborhood where almost every home was owner-occupied. And there were no boarded-up homes, and there were, well, there really wasn't an apartment building in that neighborhood even.
So, looking ahead, any particular goals and objectives for volunteering, or are you going to lay off for a while?
Well, I want to learn how to say no better.
You're not the only one I've talked to in this volunteer business that has said that, right?
But when a call comes forth and you have the skills and the time to do it, it's pretty hard not to come forth. People say, you know, I was talking to somebody yesterday discussing this, said that you know, you spend about a third of your life in education and a third of your life in working and maybe a third of your life in volunteering. That tends to be a flow that can happen to people. A lot of older people spend a lot of time volunteering in their lives. I proudly say that I said my last boss goodbye 20 years and 7 days ago. Not that I'm counting. Okay. So I've had 20 years of pretty much freedom to do this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I feel very privileged that I've had that opportunity. And I will probably again say yes to some things that don't quite fit my skills or don't fit my time and will be a little pinched. Like I know that I have two meetings today or tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock and 4:30. I have meetings that I should attend both and I simply can't.
Well, I'm sure the community has felt your worth, and I want to thank you for your ardent volunteering, and thanks for being a part of this.
Glad to be. Thanks for doing the show, Jay.
Community volunteer Mike Carlson. You're listening to Third Thursday Community Conversations, the latest installment in a series devoted to the work of volunteers in Cook County. Phyllis Parker has spent a good share of her life being with people nearing the end of their lives. She started as a hospice care volunteer, and when she moved to Cook County, became involved with Care Partners. Phyllis, tell me, you volunteer at the care center, as I understand it, once a week.
And that's correct.
What do you do when you volunteer there?
I go every Thursday. Just happened to be the day that worked best for me. And on Thursdays, I visit three different women, and I spend about a half an hour with each of the three women.
What do you talk about?
Well, it depends upon which patient you're talking about or which client you're talking about. The first one that I see has short-term memory loss and Alzheimer's. And it was just suggested that she probably could benefit by having some company, although she does have family in town. And she is delightful. It took us a while to get a rapport, you know, sort of wondering, why are you here and who are you? And I think it took a few weeks before she would recognize my face coming back each week. Now you can tell she's very happy when I walk in the door. Often she's sleeping. I mean, but I just barely touch her and say her name. And she sits right up in bed and you know, we just carry on a conversation with her. It's, I do a lot of looking at her photo albums or she also has bulletin boards on the wall that have pictures that her son has put there. And I might ask her, who is this person or who is that person? Sometimes she knows, sometimes she doesn't know. She knows that she gets confused, but she doesn't seem to be bothered by it. Sometimes she suggests that I really should be home, you know, which was Minneapolis, but then she'll say, well, I'm not sure I still have a home there, you know. So,
but it doesn't seem overly frustrated.
No,
by it,
she doesn't seem frustrated at all by it, you know. So, which is great. I mean, usually there's if I go away and I've gone for a couple of weeks or visiting my daughter, there's a connection that she and I have between where my daughter lives in Colorado and where this woman lived in Utah. And for some reason, she always remembers when I go there because she used to shop in the same town that my daughter lives in. So it's really interesting because, you know, majority of times she would might say to me, what's the weather like outside? And I'll tell her what the weather is, and it's about a minute later that she'll ask me the same question. Well, what's the weather like today? Mm-hmm. You know, and I'll say the same thing over again. I certainly would never say, oh, I just told you that. No, she's very happy, very appreciative that I come, and I always give her a Hershey's candy bar at the end, which she's she loves. And, you know, she says, oh, I hope you come back again soon. So, and then there was a Sunday, or not Sunday, a Thursday just recently where I had just visited with her, went to see another client, and then I saw her in the main large lobby area of the care center and stopped to visit with her. And she said, you haven't been to visit me for a while. But anyway.
Is that hard for you to do? Or
no, not at all. I've been volunteering for as long as I can remember, and I love elderly people. I mean, I think they're just awesome. Many people are turned off by elderly or get scared, or especially people in the care center. I think they're afraid to visit.
Now talk to me about one of the other women you talked to.
Okay, the next person that I visit is a blind woman. She's 96, and she's also from Minneapolis, and she has no other ailments, I mean, other than she's a diabetic, but I mean, she has no other cognitive ailments, and she knows exactly by what's on her television as to when I'm going to be there, and and it better be 10 o'clock or, you know, things don't go according to her plan, you know. So, and she's the only one that I have to tell if I am going to be out of town. Because she'd remember that this is Thursday and this is 10 o'clock and Phyllis comes. And we talk about, she brings up her, no, I shouldn't say resentment, but the fact that she's blind. And it was a gradual process that made her son move her up here from Minneapolis. But that's where all of her friends were. Mm-hmm. And her blindness has been a very hard transition for her because it was a slow process. And now she can barely see she can see a little bit of light, very little bit of light. But she can have tears by just talking about the things that used to be, you know, and how she used to be able to see. And I tell her, well, you're fortunate in that you do have, you know, you have your memory of what things were like. Because she said, often I'm sitting here with my eyes closed and people think I'm asleep, but she said, I'm really just trying to think about how things were. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you're fortunate that you can do that.
Does she ask you to describe things or anything?
Oh, I do. Well, the most recent thing that I described to her is the Academy Awards, because I knew that she loved them. And she couldn't wait until I came. I think the Academy Awards are on Sundays. And when I came on Thursday, she said, oh, I couldn't wait for you to tell me, you know, what did this person look like and what did that person look like? And she said, I couldn't understand such and such. And so we went through the whole thing. We spent the whole half hour talking about the Academy Awards, and she much appreciated that.
And a third?
The third person is 104. And I started out, I think it was really even before we were actually called care partners with her, and somebody just asked, is anybody able to read the News Herald to this 104-year-old woman? And you know, right away I raised my hand. And the weeks vary by, you know, week to week, because I certainly would never just sit down and read the News Herald to her. I go through and I find articles that I think would be of interest to her. She was a very active woman in the community. And then I'll say, does this sound interesting to you? And she'll either say yes or no. She doesn't like the looking back, you know, 50 years, 90 years, whatever, 10 years, which I thought would be more interesting to her. But no, she didn't want that. She loves anything that's current. Talking to her about the community center or when the library was being built, how much things cost, you know, with, and that was, you know, sometimes she says, well, I don't want to hear that anymore, how much it costs. She says, that's ridiculous. You know? And sometimes I go there and it's just, I get no reaction out of her at all. I might go a couple of weeks and she doesn't say anything. Hmm. And she's also not technically blind, but she really can't, she can probably see some figures. So she's never seen me before, nor has the woman that I talked to before, because I asked her just recently, not the 104-year-old, but the 96-year-old. I said, are you curious as to what I look like? And she said, well, I have wondered what you look like, you know. So then I tried my best to describe myself. She says, oh, now she's going to have some visual understanding of who you are.
How long have you been doing this, Phyllis?
I've been doing it for 5 years at the care center. Mm-hmm. And I don't just see those three. You know, if we have a call for a hospice patient, which is really my preference, because I had been a hospice volunteer for 20 years prior to moving here.
Where was that?
Started out in Michigan and then in Wisconsin and California, and then we finally retired and moved here.
What was that like? Describe being a hospice volunteer. What did you basically do for these people?
In those settings, it was not in a care center. They were all in their individual homes, and it was more to give respite care for the caregiver, so the caregiver could go run errands or, you know, do whatever needed to be done, and often they would open up, you know, to their feelings that they wouldn't dare say to their family. And it was wonderful. I still have connection with either Christmas cards or birthday cards or, you know, whatever, with, I'd say, 5 or 6 of these families from way back when. So I felt like, I guess, I made a difference in their lives. Some short term, some a little bit longer term.
What do you have to do to prepare for something like that yourself?
Well, I didn't have to prepare myself. There was a training session, obviously, and I think back as to how did I ever start with hospice, and I don't really know, other than I think my mother died in 87, and it was suggested to her, to us, I should say, that maybe hospice should be involved, not knowing anything other than I thought, oh, hospice means you're dying, and oh, well, we don't want anything about that, And it was like the end of the conversation, because I didn't like that word. And it didn't take me very long after Mother had died thinking, I think I need to find out more about what this hospice is all about, realizing that they really do look forward to your coming. And if it's not the patient, it's the family. I mean, truly, you get just as close to the family as you do to the patient. And they're very appreciative.
And so here, where we don't have a hospice situation, but you're going to the care center. I mean, these are people, you know, approaching end of life. So
correct.
It must be similar.
Well, it is in that the whole idea with care partners, you know, of course, care partners started out wanting to be a hospice.
Right.
And, you know, that didn't work. And that, of course, that's what drew me in the first place to this group. Because it was advertised probably in 2007, I think, that they wanted to start a hospice. And I thought, oh, there it is. Because when I first moved here, I checked with the county and asked if we had a hospice program. And they said, no, sorry, we don't have any. And I explained that what I had done in the past. and they suggested respite care, which is what I did until this 2007 came along. So sort of the same concept, going to people's houses and giving respite care to the caregiver.
You say you enjoy working and being with older people. What is that? What about that is that draws you?
It's probably understanding their struggles, knowing I'm getting older myself, and understanding the frustrations that they're going through, especially the ones at the care center, as to how they ended up at the care center, you know, and to try to help them, try to make a difference in their life. And I do feel like I have made a difference in their lives.
It sounds like
it's, and it's personally satisfying. I mean, that's a little strange, especially for people who say, you know, how do you say you enjoy hospice? It's a hard concept to explain to somebody who doesn't want anything to be around somebody who is dying or frail elderly.
And that that sounds like it has attracted you for a long time.
It has. Well, it's over 20 years mm-hmm. since I started.
Did going through the period with your own mother's death have an impact on you in that way?
Well, I think it did. I mean, I didn't think so at the time, because at the time, like I said, the word hospice was a word I didn't like. We don't need anybody else. You know, we can do it ourselves. You know, there's six children in my family, or five siblings. And I guess the word just was never in my vocabulary prior to that.
So this is not something, I mean, aside from a little training, this is not something that you ever did as a part of your work life?
No, not part of work. It's always been volunteer.
You volunteer for anything else?
I do.
What?
I'm the secretary of the Maple Hill Fire Department. I'm a treasurer of Bethlehem Lutheran Church Women. And when there was the mushwork here, I'm in charge of registration. And whatever else happens to come along, my husband is a volunteer also, so it's just part of who we are.
I've had many conversations with volunteers as a part of this project, and I find that that's true, that it's far more common to find people that will volunteer for several things. Now, these other things that you volunteer for sound a little more like a little more administrative as opposed to empathetic.
That's correct. They are. Those are administrative. I mean, they're really, I can't think of anything else. Well, I'm busy enough, I should say, and I work 2 days a week at the most at the trading post. It's what I can fit in right now, but if somebody suggests that they need a little help, I'll be there to help.
Okay.
It seems like the people who are the busiest are the people that are asked to volunteer. That, you know, I feel like I should be giving back to the community, and that's what I've done every place that we've lived.
Care Partners volunteer, Phyllis Parker. You're listening to Third Thursday Community Conversations, the latest installment in a series devoted to the work of volunteers in Cook County. Vicki Biggs Anderson is a WTIP volunteer commentator with her Magnetic North features. She also has started a group for caregivers who are involved with loved ones gravely ill or at the end of their lives. You are a volunteer here at WTIP.
Yes, I am.
And primarily through writing and recording a commentary, mm-hmm. Magnetic North.
Yeah.
So tell us about why you do that.
Well, why do I do it? Writing, per se, is not, it's something I can do, but it's hard for me. I'm not drawn to write. Some people feel writing is an addiction. I feel it's more of a burden. I sit there until a small bead of blood appears on my forehead, and then I write. I mean, it's difficult. But living where I do, I see things and feel things that I am compelled, for some reason, to write down. And once I started writing that thing down, like the great gray owl that was starving at the end of my driveway, I go on and on. And somehow it makes connections for me that help me deal with life in general. I mean, I've always felt that way about animals and nature, so That's a roundabout way of why I write. I think that's a heck of a question to start out with, if you don't mind my saying so. Anyway.
Well, but you, what you do write in Magnetic North is very specific, site-specific.
Mm-hmm. It is, yes.
And that's because you live out in the country and appreciate mm-hmm. what it is you see out in the country.
Yeah.
And maybe this is a way to share that.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit before we started the interview about sharing the place I live, and that was something that Paul always loved to do. He loved to have people out to the farm. He made miles and miles of trails back in the woods over a decade, and a little primitive cabin back on the Little Brule. And we would have get-togethers where groups of people would come out, but just at the time when he started to get really too ill to enjoy the place, where company, people moved into the neighborhood with kids, people who wanted to use the trails to ski in the winter, snowshoe, and kept them open when he could no longer do it. And people up the road, the Whartons, started a CSA on an acre that's right on the road, and we were happy to let them have it for in exchange for some veggies. And it, the land is being used now in a tangible way. I think in my writing, I felt like I was sharing the property in a less tangible way, but people had a feeling that they've been there or they knew what it was like. I've had people come to get eggs and say, oh, it's just the way I thought it would be. That makes me feel good.
You're not a country girl.
No! I grew up mainline Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Never really comfortable at that. But my mother was, when I moved her up here, she kept saying, I don't know where you get this, Victoria. and yet I was just going through some family photos this past week, and I saw one of my great-great aunts, Aunt Hetty Davis, had a farm. So my mother was... My mother twisted the truth from, you know.
She was keeping something
she was,
from you.
She must not have been fond of that part of mm-hmm. our heritage.
But you have really taken it over for yourself, and I think
yeah.
Convey to a lot of people, including me, because I live in the boonies too, mm-hmm. and have for a long time,
yeah.
both here and previously. But there's a kind of a flavor to it that I think a lot of people who think of Cook County don't necessarily think of it in quite the way. You referred to it just now as a farm. And
mm-hmm.
there aren't very many of those in Cook County. There
no.
were at some point. But
oh, there really were all around the lake.
Mm-hmm.
There were. And there are more farms on the South Shore now, especially in the Bayfield area. I mean, that's really semi-booming. But there are still some farms here with regular good animals. I mean, I have goats, and most farmers would snort at that. You had goats, so you know
yes,
the feeling.
Yes, I
it's
did.
It's sort of a little find guilty your, pleasure.
Yeah, I find your affection for goats interesting. I outgrew it, but that's okay.
I've just about outgrown it myself this past winter, having to snowshoe to the barn.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go in the barn with snowshoes, so you have to take them off, which is an ugly sight if anyone's watching. I'm glad I live as far out as I do, because the words that went filtering off into the ethers this winter, I'm telling you.
Well, you didn't record them for us, I know.
No, but I think you've heard them.
Yeah, right. Well, do you plan these things? I you know, the drop of blood thing, I've heard that before from you too.
Yeah.
But I mean, are these things that just, you know, you see and you figure that's really kind of neat, I want to share that with
yeah.
people?
Yeah. I'm doing one on that owl as we speak. Actually, it's been on my computer now for over a month and a half. But looking at that creature, trying to make it easier for her to catch things, I'd throw cracked corn on the snow to attract mice. I mean, she wasn't very near the house. It made me think about the way we see creatures in need and either try to help them, or when we can't help them, turn our backs on them, maybe, or look away, try and get preoccupied with something else. And then it seems like one thought leads to another and to another. And sometimes it's funny and sometimes it's not. Most of the time I find a humorous slant to things, mostly at my own expense. I've got, like, right now, I mean, last year was so wonderful. The spring, we were already filling our window boxes. So I thought, I'm going to get a jump on it. I'm not going to wait until November to have an egg. So I ordered chickens to be delivered here the 1st of April. And they're still in my bathroom downstairs. They have now left the shower stall. And yes, the floor is covered. But still, I mean, that does something to one's thinking. I have more than one bathroom, but I have to use that one on occasion. And it's just, I mean, it colors my world, so to speak. And why would I do that? And, you know.
But a lot of us did that this year. I didn't order chickens, but you
order geese?
No.
Did you? Mm-hmm.
Oh, and they are?
I don't want to talk about
it. Okay, we won't talk about the geese. but what I'm getting at here is that it really seems like you are, in your own way, chronicling things that happen to you that also happen to other people because you're responding to a time of year. You're not being philosophical about it necessarily.
I haven't come up with anything new and different. I haven't. Every once in a while, I'll get a note from someone from afar or close by that says, you know, I know just how you feel, or I hadn't thought of things that way, but that's just the reason I come up there, or that I want to be there, or that kind of thing. And it's really neat.
You mentioned Paul, and you've really taken an interest in being a caregiver. You've been doing some work with Care Partners, but talk about this latest move on your part to work with, a support group for people who do give care to other folks.
My caregiver coach at Care Partners, Jeanette Lindgren, and I were just talking one day about a support group. There used to be a support group for caregivers at the courthouse, and it just disbanded for one reason or another. I think the facilitator moved on, I'm not sure. But we were thinking about, what if there were just an informal group, not really led by anyone credentialed? And so I and another former caregiver make sure that the group is there every third Tuesday of a month. And we bring treats and drinks, and whoever shows up, we can just talk about what they're experiencing as caregivers. It's not a place to go and get tips per se, although tips have been given, but it is a way of connecting with other people who've had the same life experiences, caring for someone pretty much round the clock, and in some cases becoming just as housebound as that individual. Being able to leave the house because the person can quote-unquote take care of themselves becomes more and more iffy for most of us. And that creates a lot of issues emotionally that I think only others in that same situation can really appreciate. And it's good to have those things validated. I found Care Partners also trains volunteers who will go into a person's home and stay with the person needing care while the caregiver gets out and does shopping or whatever, and can really take a deep breath and know that their loved one is cared for, and this is a part of the group. We had 14 people show up the first time, and it's only met twice. The second time, there were only 6 of us, but that was just fine. It's an hour to an hour and a half, however long people want to come. It's at the Congregational Church, third Tuesday of every month at noon.
Had you thought about doing that while you were caring for Paul, or is it just something that kind of struck you?
It just sort of struck me. I have for decades participated in various support groups and found them very healing, helpful. I've made friends there, but basically I've gotten support. I mean, just haven't felt... It's hard to verbalize, but I think that I know that one woman who came to the first group said that she just, it just helped to know that there were other folks in the same boat, and she had picked up some ideas that she could use, that kind of thing. So I guess that's why it just struck me. Why not do it on this issue? I mean, in Cook County, we have a lot of groups. We've got 12-step groups. We've got grief groups. We've got this. There started a women's in transition group. One church has this retirees and wannabes group. I think we're just a bunch of groupies up here, frankly.
What's the future look like in terms of writing and commenting and volunteering for you?
Well, I don't have any plans to do anything differently at writing more often. I hit a real snag this winter after I was busy when Paul went into the vet's home in September. You know, just a whirlwind. I could go anywhere, do anything, and then boom. Actually, right about the time the support group started, I felt like I didn't have any rudder. And my writing suffered. I don't think that's unusual. I think creative people, you know, if they're emotionally down, where do you get that juice to do it? So I haven't written a column for a couple months. As I said, I have this thing on my desktop computer, and the date keeps changing from February 2013, March 2000. And now so hopefully I'll get back to that. But I'm just going to keep doing what I've been doing, you know, keeping the farm together and the chickens cooped up and the pine martens out and the goats' hooves trimmed and so forth and so on. The only change really for me has been going down to Silver Bay to see Paul twice a week or more. Otherwise, I'm just me.
Do writers write about themselves all the time, really underneath it all?
I heard somebody asked about that. I mean, I think people usually do ask that of writers. Some writers deny it, but how can they? Where did they get the ideas? Unless they stole a manuscript from somebody else. No, that's not about them, but it has to be about myself, all about me. But not, it maybe not all about. If you're a reporter, you should try and keep your beeswax out of that as much as possible, but we don't always do it.
Okay.
And I'm more guilty than anybody else, but yeah, I'm pretty opinionated.
Vicki Biggs Anderson. Shortly after we recorded this interview, her husband Paul passed away at the Veterans Facility in Silver Bay. Jeff Kern and Kathy Sullivan volunteer with the Violence Prevention Center. They take calls from people in a state of domestic crisis, and when the opportunity arises, work with them as advocates. So let's start with you, Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
This is new for you, right?
Right. I just started training last December and finished in January. So went on the list in February. And
yeah, how does that work? I mean, if I need to talk to the Violence Prevention Center, there's two numbers. One's the office and one is the hotline, so to speak. They're not specifically calling you.
No, what happens is we sign up on a calendar, and that is given to Law Enforcement Center, and people can call into the Law Enforcement Center. Law Enforcement Center takes their name and phone number that they can be reached at and then calls us, and then we call the client.
So you're kind of on a rotation basis with several other people.
Right, yep.
And Jeff, you've been doing this for quite a while.
Yeah, pretty much since I came to town, and I came in 91, so shortly thereafter, I think, got involved in the VPC.
Well, the next question is why? What led you to do that kind of volunteering?
Oh, boy, I've been doing this since I was in college. In Iowa City, I was on the Iowa City Crisis Intervention Center's call team. I was a trainer there. I did that for 5 or 6 years. So helping people in crisis is something I've been doing for a long time. I enjoy doing it. The training has been excellent. It carries over to all kinds of other situations. It's all about how to establish a relationship with somebody in a short time in a crisis situation, and you get to help people, and you get to meet interesting people in interesting situations and difficult situations, and it's been a really useful, I guess, set of tools that I've acquired as training and trainer in those situations. And then when I came here, it was just natural to start over again with the Violence Prevention Center.
Well, Kathy, what prompts you to do this kind of volunteer work, and have you done it before?
I've not done it formally before, but I've been involved with a couple friends who were going through some really rough times and I felt like I could be there for them. I think it's something that I can do. I think there's a need in the community, and when I found out about the Violence Prevention Center, I thought, well, it would be a good thing for me to be an advocate there.
And you've been here in the county how long?
2.5 years.
Hmm. So pretty soon.
Yes.
Right. Talk a little bit about the training that you got here. I mean, what do you do? You never know when you're going to get a call, so you must have practiced this with people.
We did. That was part of the training. Part of the training is online classes that are set up by the Department of Justice. So anyone that's involved in this kind of work has to go through a certain amount of these classes. So we would do the online classes, and then we would have a discussion session with Lucy and Jody. Mm-hmm. And then toward the end, we did quite a few role-playings, playing either the victim or playing the part of the advocate. Lucy made up some tough situations that were kind of interesting.
Yeah, just so people real, Lucy Perpich and Jody Yahasi are the two women,
yes,
that staff at the Violence Prevention Center. Now, Jeff, you've been involved in a lot of different crisis situations like in Iowa, but here, what kinds of crises are we talking about?
The ones that I've had often involve either just talking to somebody who's in a scary situation and trying to help them safe, make themselves safe, find resources to take care of what their problems are, and maybe educate them a little bit about the bigger picture of domestic violence and how what they're telling me fits into that picture, kind of reassure them that they're not alone and that they need to take the steps to make themselves safe. Sometimes it involves safe housing. We have access to resources in the community where we can put people up for a night or two to get away from a scary situation. And there's other resources too, orders for protection. We help people fill out the forms and talk through some of the issues involved with that. If there is a domestic assault or a sexual assault, we're trained to go to the hospital with the victim and be there as an advocate for them.
Well, it's at some point in this process, you need to turn the situation over to somebody, either at the center or in law enforcement. What's the process? At what point does that happen?
Often law enforcement's involved first, and they contact us. So we go there to support the victim after the law enforcement pieces have been handled.
So this isn't just a phone call at night. This is, they call you after the person has come in to law enforcement, or what?
Or after they've been out on the scene.
What do you do?
You have to help them realize that they aren't alone, as Jeff said. Mm-hmm. That there is someone there that will stand beside them and will walk with them and will listen to them. And that right there at that moment, they are the most important, that person is the most important person in the world. And that, you know, I will listen to you and I will walk with you and I will help you get whatever it is that you need right now.
I'd make a distinction between, okay, let's say law enforcement's already there and they've called us to support the victim. That's one situation. If someone's called and they're in a scary situation without law enforcement, then their personal safety is a huge concern of ours. And we find the resources and find the ways to help them feel safe and be safe. So that's a little bit different dynamic.
I think a lot of us tend to think that it's the phone call in the middle of the night, but it's what I'm hearing from you is that a great deal of this is actual on-site, hands-on, there to be with the individual, so that when you become a volunteer, it seems to me to be a much bigger commitment.
Well, as far as turning things over, what we do when we're on call at night is somewhat limited. And it often means that we advise them to come into the center the next day and talk to Jody and Lucy and do some of the more day-to-day paperwork, counseling, looking for further resources. We don't always have a lot available in the middle of the night. So we're into housing and safety and law enforcement, and there's other resources. But basically, it's the emergency stuff. And the long-term ongoing things are handled by Lucy and Jody during the week, during the daytime.
What part of your training revolves around the actual in-person kind of thing? Give me kind of an idea of how they prepare you to do that.
Well, I'm prepared that if there's a physical problem, and I would meet them at the hospital. So that would be one time that I would be one-on-one. If there's a sexual assault, I could meet them at the hospital. If they need safe housing, I would meet them at the particular place that we're going to put them for the evening. So those would be the times that I would be one-on-one. And what happens at those one-on-one meetings depends on what the need is. So whether we're at the point to start to fill out a protection order or it just depends on what's going on.
Our own safety becomes fairly important too.
I was about to ask.
There's a lot of times when it's not safe and we need law enforcement backup, or we need to find a neutral place to meet. We're very careful about what we would do with our own safety.
But it seems to me that there would be some danger, because the individual that's causing the problem in this relationship is not going to take it lightly.
The fact is, those situations are pretty darn rare. In my time here, I've had a handful of cases where I've actually gone out and spoken with people on a scene or at a safe house or in their home. Each situation is individual, and I've had law enforcement be there in the house with me. I've had them make sure the scene is clear. I've had them escort people to a location with me. And I've done it without law enforcement when there's been a safe location somewhere as well where we can meet mutually. But it's one of those case-by-case things, and they're never the same. Part of this whole volunteer thing with the Violence Prevention Center, only a very small part of it's actually doing crisis calls. I think most of what we do is training, and there's a lot of other activities that go along with it, like the work that the Violence Prevention Center does in the schools, keeping in touch with volunteers, keeping in touch with the board, some of the other initiatives about healthy relationships in the community. And I think those of us that do the crisis counseling also do a lot of the backup and help with some of the other activities as well.
The Violence Prevention Center has an advocacy program. Are you involved in that in any way?
As I understand it, if you really form a relationship with a person in the middle of the night and they do end up with a court appearance, if they would like you to be there and you are available, then, well, I would go, but it isn't required.
Have you ever done that, Jeff?
I've spent several hours in court, yeah.
This is with people that you've worked with? And
not necessarily. Sometimes it's just general support with people that I...
So coming into the situation later.
Yeah, or coming into the courtroom to support the victim with friendly faces.
This is a big commitment. What do you get out of this?
I feel a need to be there to help people. I mean, that's inbred in me. I don't know. I was a school teacher. What do? You help kids. So that's part of one of my own personal needs. And I think I can do a good job at it.
It's a hard question to answer, but I think it's because we come across this stuff all the time in our lives with our friends and our acquaintances and so forth. And having been trained to do some of these crisis things, helping people in stressful situations, it gives me some tools to help people when I can. And so it extends way beyond just the calls I get at the Violence Prevention Center. Like Kathy says, there's a big payoff in just feeling like you're competent and able to help people in certain places, and knowing that you have enough understanding to feel like you can actually do some good. I think there's also something about being part of the community, being part of that part of the community that's in touch with issues and problems, and having a better understanding of ways the community needs to heal or to focus energy. A whole lot of our issues need to be addressed with school kids. We can't solve it with laws. We can't solve it with prisons. But I think there is some hope if we help young kids understand what is a healthy relationship, what makes a good community, what kind of things they can do to feel empowered in the community. So part of it's just an awareness that can be put to good use.
As a former teacher, you must know that quite well.
I think self-esteem, building self-esteem in a child is one of the most important things we can do. And if they have self-esteem, if they believe in themselves, then hopefully they will make the decisions that will keep themselves safe.
And I think that the more aware we are of issues like domestic violence, the more we're able to spot those issues around us. If I see somebody with a black eye, I'm going to pay a little more attention about where that black eye came from and have a better awareness of the possibilities and how how those play out in terms of what they tell you versus what actually happened. It's a little more in-depth understanding of and what we can do to help fix it if we can.
Violence Prevention Center volunteer Kathy Sullivan and Jeff Kern. You've been listening to Third Thursday Community Conversations, part of a series devoted to the work of volunteers in Cook County. We hope you enjoy hearing their stories and consider contributing some of your time and talents to one or more of our many local nonprofits and agencies. Tonight we've been speaking with volunteers Jeff Kern and Kathy Sullivan, Vicki Biggs Anderson, Mike Carlson, and Phyllis Parker. And that will have to do it for tonight. We'll be back with another edition of Third Thursday at 7 p.m. on July 18th. For WTIP North Shore Community Radio, I'm Jay Anderson.